Are you ready?
Yeah, this is it. Okay, ready? No, I'm not ready.
What happened? You're not.
I am not ready. Sorry, man.
It's okay.
I was ready.
Are we recording? Probably.
Yeah.
We'll just leave this in at the beginning.
To see examples of what we talk about on this episode, along with further information, go to bunchofdorks.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Two Dimension Podcast,
the comic book podcast
with no direction.
I'm Don Moore, and you're listening to Two Dimension, the comic book podcast with no direction. And sitting across from me is a man that told me, you become the noun by doing the verb. And that can only be Mr.
Al. Yeah, I forgot that I'd said that. I forget a lot of things that I say. There's so many things that have been written down that I've said that I keep forgetting. I'm like the Mark Twain or something, or the Will Rogers of comic book podcast quotes, I guess. I don't know. So anyway, we're here, and we're here to talk about stuff.
Comic books.
Comic books and stuff. And water.
So and water.
There's a lot of comic books around here. And the funny thing about it is I haven't read one of them this week. So I should have read them, but I've been doing other things. So I'm hoping you read some stuff or you came prepared. You came with bullets in the hole.
Yeah,
because I'm going to do a pull-a-palooza. I don't know what to talk about.
Oh, that's always good. I was telling Dallas, I want a theme song for pull-a-palooza.
I was gonna look for something.
And I want some type of real heavy guitar. And I kept telling him, and I'm always talking to Steve Robinson about I want a ditty for the dollar box. You know, we were talking about pulling things for the dollar box. And I was trying to write one myself. And I'll tell you, I cannot write songs. But I told Steve Robinson, he goes, "What do you mean a ditty?" I says, "Well, you know, something like, more fun than throwing rocks is digging through the dollar box."
That's good. More fun than getting hit by rocks is digging through the dollar box.
Hey, there you go.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, something like that with a guitar or something. I was trying to get him to do it. He just laughs. He goes, "Well, it looks okay. I can't play guitar." And I was telling Dallas, and Dallas got some type of thing that plugs in the computer. He can plug his guitar in the computer.
Oh, yeah?
And he said, "You know what that means? I can start recording a lot of things." And I said, because I'm always joking with him about the pull-a-palooza. I want a power riff, you know. I want pull-a-palooza! And, or with Dallas, he'd be pull-a-palooza!
His singer, his buddy. His
but he said he's going to do it, and I'm thinking, yeah, and then something for a dollar box, you know. But
see, for pull-a-palooza, I was thinking of playing like one of those.
Well, see, that would be fun, too.
Just go, "Hey, you know what time it is? It's pull-a-palooza time." And at the end go like, and then, okay, like in Monty Python. Okay, but anyway.
Well, that would be good. But you know, it's funny, we're talking about surrounded by comics. There was times when I wasn't able to go to a store, you know, I'd start pulling out, like, I had Akira, you know, I had the whole series, I read them as they came out, but at one point...
I completely forgot we were recording.
Oh, that's okay. But, no direction.
Yeah.
But I pulled out Akira and started reading them in sequence, you know, I think there was like 45 issues of it, and reading it month to month...
145 issues?
No, I think it was 45. 45,
okay, 45. Yeah, that makes more sense.
Somewhere around that. But, you know, before when it first came out, it was coming out monthly. And so many things were happening. And I remember each month I would get to, sometimes I'd forget about secondary characters that came in and what happened and how they showed up. Wait a minute, what is this? Did I miss an issue? And then I'd pull back and read a few. Oh, okay, it is happening. But it's like we talked about heavy metal when you read things serialized compared to getting the actual piece. Anyway, I pulled out Akira and I read, you know, every day I'd read, you know, one book. Reads much different. You know, it reads fast and, you know, cohesive. And I was doing that all the time. I was pulling out like George Perez's Wonder Woman. You know, I read Dark Knight. I read Watchmen. You know, but I just started pulling out Walt Simonson's Thor. I'd reread. And that was the thing. Sometimes you think about, you know, I need to go to the comic store, get my comics, because I have nothing to read. And I go, I got all this stuff here. So you start pulling out and reading it. But that's the thing, is sometimes you get it and you put it on your shelf and
you don't get around to it.
I think Dallas, last time we did a show, Dallas was joking about he had a book for so many years. And, well, you were even talking about Bravo, that Alex Toth.
Bravo Adventure, yeah.
Yeah. You said you'd bought it and it's 15 years later you reread it, which to me is not a bad thing. It's nice to have things, but sometimes it can sit on a shelf and you never pull it out.
Yeah, I know. Like, I'm looking over here, you know, it's like, oh, look at that. Wow, look at that. All these magazines here that I haven't read in 20 years. Wow, there you go.
But that's a fun thing, too. Like, sometimes we lend books to each other. I was talking about my friend Juan from Spain. When I talked to him, I'd ask him questions about comics, you know, in Spain. And one time he came and told me, he says, you know, Don, you always ask me that. There was one comic that was my very favorite when I lived in Spain. And he says, I don't have any, but I'm going to ask my friend, you know, I'm going to write him and ask him to send it to me. It was called Asterix. And I said, I must have 40 of those at home. They're in English. Asterix is, you know, a French comic, but it's been translated in almost every language, including Latin, you know. And so I started bringing those in, and he was reading them. And then what the fun part of it was that those books, the art and the stories were just great. They were great fun. But he was bringing up things like when they went to this one section going to Spain, it always has this traffic jam. Of course, it's all people on carts with oxes and, you know, wagons and stuff like that, but they're all yelling at each other. And he was saying what this is the French go to Spain on vacation, and they're driving RV vehicles and campers, and it's always a big traffic jam because Spain has narrow lanes. And he says, I never thought of that. I didn't realize it was the French coming through and, you know, causing trouble. The Mansion of the Gods is basically, they built a huge Roman settlement there, and they put people in it, and the Romans just started going to the Gaulish village of Asterix, and they completely destroyed the village. What they were doing was they were buying everything, and they had a fishmonger in Asterix. He was one of the main characters, sold fish, and they had another guy that was a blacksmith. Well, these Roman housewives would come in and buy fish, and how much is it? And they were always shocked at how little it was, you know, how cheap it was. And then they'd buy shields and helmets and whatever as decorations for their place, and they'd call it antiques. And they were always amazed at, you know, how inexpensive everything was. So these two guys started raising their price. Next thing you know, everyone in the village was either an antique dealer or a fishmonger. And they couldn't get anything else they needed because everybody's selling it. And then at one point they went to buy a fish, and they said, how much is the fish? And it was astronomical. It says, well, just the other day you were selling them for this much. I don't need your business. I got all these other people to buy from me. You know, and Juan was explaining to me what happened. He said, that's when, after World War II, when they were building all these American air bases and army bases in Spain, he says the American dependents' wives were hiring these Spanish women as maids. And he says, all of a sudden, the Spanish couldn't afford maids because the Americans were paying far more money for them. And he says it completely destroyed the economy in Spain because they were dependent on the American air base. And when I say that, American military people don't make squat. Here in the United States, they couldn't afford it, but when you go to another country, and a different standard of living. But he was bringing up context to the Asterix books, not being European, I never would have got. Well, after he read all those, I lent him Valerian, you know, which is one of my favorites, and then I started lending him all the Mobius books. And he read through every one of those. Then he got excited to find out I had the Spirit. He lived in Puerto Rico for a while, and he used to read the Spirit all the time in the paper. So I started bringing him all the different Spirit books I had. And then after he read all those, I said, well, I got an American comic. You want to try it? At first, he wasn't real interested. But then he did, and it was Gru the Wanderer. He read every issue I had of Gru, you know, and he thought they were the greatest. And what was fun was when I get these, I'd bring him a book, and the next day I'd pull another book out and I'd read through it before I gave it to him so we could talk. I'll tell you, there's nothing more fun than lending your friends comics and then being able to read them again and talk about them, which is, again, why we do this show. So, I don't know. It's a great problem to have when you got tons of comics around, but it's an easy thing just to leave them on the shelves and boxes
and
not touch them.
New ones, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's all about getting new old ones or new ones or whatever.
Yeah, but you reread things all the time.
Not as much as you guys do, I don't think. I usually look at it one time and then I just move on. But if it's the art's really nice, then I will go back and read and examine it in a different way. Not for the story. I mean, once I read the story, I'm kind of... whatever, you know, I read the story, that's fine, but I will re-immerse myself in the artwork and stuff like that, because I like the shorter stories. I was noticing that from reading short stories or whatever, it's a different feel than when you read a long, you know, drawn out, whatever, graphic novel, which is a great read, possibly, but with the short story, since they have to fill up so many storylines, you get some of the craziest storylines. Every once in a while, some of them really, like, 5 pages, they hit you hard, you know what I mean? You know, it's kind of like you just get to the point as opposed to a character study or whatever, which becomes the longer comic book thing. So it's like, I don't know, you know, like I said, when I read a story, I'm reading it, I'm done with it, I move on. But if I like the art, I will go back to it. Like, you know, artists did a really good job on it, I will go back. But generally, no, I don't, you know, I don't really reread much of anything. I relook.
I re-look,
yeah.
Well, you know, that is something, because I talk about the Harvey comics, like Richie Rich and stuff. All those stories were short, you know, 5 pages. And sometimes, like Ernie Colon, he was an artist that convinced them to do kind of adventure stories. You know, each artist, Howie Post, he'd do adventure too, but his were more fun. You know, Warren Kremer, the main Richie Rich artist, his was always... gimmicky, neat, you know, like, you know, the gadgets and all the stuff that Richie Rich had. But Ernie Colon, his were always two-parters, and so it was like, you know, 5-6 pages. It was always like a 12-page story or 10-page story. Said so much in them, you know. I mean, they were like, to me, epic James Bond type movies.
Yeah, sure. You know, what I'd like to see. I think it's been done before. Pretty sure it has, and you'll probably say, "Oh yeah, I was done here." I'd like to see a book or a bigger book, not necessarily a comic book, with 10 artists, different artists who work on, and I like to see their interpretation of the same story.
Yeah.
Has that been done before? Just a book. It's like that record where everybody, all these different bands do Stairway to Heaven.
Yeah.
I'd like to see like a classic story, say like a Poe or whatever, and have 10 different artists just draw the same story, and just to see how everybody tackles the same subject. That'd be pretty interesting to see. I'm guessing this must have been done somewhere.
You would think.
What there is I could probably go back and try to find like an adaptation of a Poe story and done in the 50s and the 60s, and you could probably like dig something up like that, you know, which I might do one day if I can figure going through Grandfather's Diary. But it'd be nice if they got like 10 artists from today and go, okay, here's the story, the Telltale Heart. I want to see how every one of you attacks this story. I'd like to see, because that to me is more interesting. The way an artist, or even a writer too, because they're writing, visualizes or adapts a story, as opposed to like just new stories, you know, because I like to see different ways of storytelling and the mechanics of it, you know. So, but I'm just going to look around. I know that there's a couple of different versions of some Poe stuff. I know there's a guy who's got a blog that catalogs them, so I'm going to try to look it up and see it, because it's interesting.
Yeah, it would be neat. I never thought of it, but it'd be neat if you had like a story, one script, and you, like you said, had 10 different artists do it.
And writers too adapt it differently.
Oh, you know? I got you. Well,
it could be just the artist. You know, the artist adapting as just a regular story.
You know, I want to see. I've seen examples of that. Like, Comic Scene Magazine, when they had the whole thing about how to write comics and how to draw comics. And I remember they had I think it was Irv Novick and I think it was Dick Dillon were the two.
They would draw the same page or something?
Well, I don't know if they did that on purpose, but they were getting references, and they'd show the script, and they would show how the different artists drew that same script. And it was interesting because I think, don't quote me, but I think one was Irv Novick and one was Dick Dillon. And again, these weren't artists I liked as, you know, when I was younger.
Yeah.
But it was interesting to see how they drew, because it was a talking page. It wasn't a superhero fight. It was like playing like a Jim Aparo type style story. And one of them, it had heads, but it's different angles and different, you know, perspectives and stuff. The other artist, their page, it was a lot of long shots, like full bodies in a room talking, and completely different. It looked more like a movie. And I mean, when I say that they were quiet, you know, kind of pedestrian pages, but all of a sudden I was in college and I read that and I was really impressed, like, wow. Because how many times you see people when they're new, and I'm putting mine in, when you have people talking, you draw one head on one side of the panel, one head on the other side of the panel facing each other, and it's like just the most boring thing in the world.
Well, that's like that, that's like that, and it's copywritten now by, you know, X whoever. It's probably online too. There's like a guide. It's like a guide by Wally Wood, and it's called his 22 panels to.
That always work. That's always on the internet.
That's how you.
It's copywritten.
I think Spurlock copywrote it. Yeah, he owns like, quote unquote, the Wally Wood things that he actually didn't do for other companies. It was passed down to him by, I forget who else. I don't know, but Bill Pearson or somebody like that. And I'm pretty sure that I saw it online and had a C on it. Mm. So I think he has the ownership too. But yeah, that's the way you take a boring, you know, you do like a shot from above, you do a shot from you do like a shot of like the outside of the house where they're talking with a word balloon.
Yeah, it's a bunch of little panels he put together.
Yeah, to break up the monotony of
it. It was a number. I don't remember, like
22.
Yeah, okay. 22 panels that always work. And when I say that, they're not dynamic, but they're simple and effective. And there's one cartoonist I like on Facebook. He posted that, and he said that I guess when he was younger, he got it from somebody else, you know, before the internet. Somebody passed it on to him, and he said he's always had that by his desk. Whenever he gets stuck, he pulled it out. It says, it always worked for me. I mean, this is a prominent guy.
Well, you know what I had one time? I don't know where it is now. It's in a fold or something. I could... Don't ask me to find it. I mean, if I do find it, I'll put it on there one day, but I don't know exactly where it is. Back a long time ago, I was having a real tough time figuring out a comic book page. You know, I would show it to people and go, well, that's nicely drawn, but you really, you know, you got to vary it or whatever. You know, you got to, like, look at the panels. So then one day this guy, Andy Warner, gives me a bunch of photocopies. Apparently he went to some seminar in, like, a New York comic convention in the early 70s, and Steranko was giving a lecture about, like, comic books. And basically, Steranko wrote down in pages, you know, like, here's the story, here's the shots that you need in a story or in a page, here's this. And it was the most enlightening thing they ever read, because he basically said, okay, if you want to go to a new scene, you have to establish this. Just show the entire scene so you know where everybody is in relationship to everybody. Or if you're going to a new building, show the entire building, or show something to say, I've moved from this point to that point. Okay, then you can have a two-shot where two people, either they're talking to each other, like face-to-face, or then you have a trick shot from above or from below just to break it up. And then you have a close-up. And then you could have another medium shot or whatever. But it's like, that's how you break up, you know, monotony, or then you, between that and the Wally Wood 22 panels, you pretty much solved a lot of, you know. Now, if they give you five pages of that, then you got to go to a romance comic and see, you know, how to do it, because that'll show you exactly how to make boring interesting.
Well, that was the thing. Whenever I drew, I just drew in sketchbooks, and I was always doing character design. And you always read about guys that are in comics. They said, when you were younger, were you doing comics? And I said, well, no. I was basically just doing pinups. But you thought there was comics. You're drawing superhero characters or whatever.
Yeah.
And that's what we all did. And I remember I saw Dick Giordano in 82 in Dallas. And he's looking at portfolios, but on his panel, he said, look, He says, what I'm looking for is if you can tell a story. And he says, I'm looking for pages and sequences and seeing how you can do it. That's what I'm looking for. So you have drawings of, you know, Batman or something. I'll say, well, this is nice. He says, but I'm looking to see if you can tell a story. And I thought, what? And whenever I would attempt to draw a story, I'm thinking, well, this is kind of hard. I mean,
it is.
It's okay to draw. Well, see, when you brought me those old comics from you drew in the 80s, I was shocked at just how deft your storytelling was, and you were changing panels. And
the writer helped me out a lot in some of those, because the guy I was working, Stewart, he was pretty, he would look at the page and go, yeah, that's good. And he goes, I really want this shot in here. So it helps sometimes to have somebody visual who's a writer to help you with, as opposed to somebody that just gives you type.
Yeah.
Sometimes it helps.
Yeah, I met a guy in Tampa. He was, I don't know, he was from Georgia or something, but he had a comic. He was a writer, and Michael Kluta was at that show, and I gave Michael Kluta my comic I published. And then he saw it, and he talked to me for a while. It was really nice. And he said, this looks like fun. And he was talking about maybe working together. And the artist that he was working for was, I thought, second to none. You know, he was another, new guy. But I told him, I says, I would like that. He says, but an issue I have is I don't know if I could draw something somebody else wants. And he gave me some scripts. They were pretty neat.
Kluta did?
No, not Kluta. This guy from, I'm guessing he was from Georgia.
Oh, okay.
I don't know his name. He was nice, but he said, there was three short stories he wrote. And he says, when I write, I try to give the artist a visualization. It was just text, but I read it. I thought, yeah, you're absolutely right. He does, like one of them was a story about a raccoon. And he's talking about the raccoon got into a gas station bathroom. And, he, in so many words, he described it. It wasn't like I was blind and have to interpret everything myself.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
I thought, well, actually, I could see. Of course, the thing was I was busy with work and, things were going on. I wouldn't have been able to do the kind of work you wanted. But that's an issue when you try to do a story. And you bring this all the time. When we talk about artists we didn't like as kids and, we changed. You said, try to do better. Well, that's a tall order because even if it's an artist that you hated, they could still tell a story, regardless if it was as good as, say, Bernie Rising.
Because
could do.
You'll get an artist who may not be the most dazzling, but if he can make the page look good and tell a story and do it in time, you'll get another job.
Well, that's the other thing. When you start reading some of these fantastic stories by, Mobius, Barry Smith and all that, and you start trying to do some of this stuff, you fall on your face.
Pretty much.
You have to learn how to walk before you can learn how to fly. But when I was in college, I would try to do stuff, and I try to make it more dynamic, and people would read it and goes, it's losing me. What's happening here? Well, it's because, I had panels going all over the place, circular movement and stuff.
Right.
And, it's like when you learn to play keyboards, instead of actually playing a song, you're just doing beeps and stuff because you like the sound, So.
Yeah, because it's not fun to draw. I don't think it's not fun to draw people come out of cars. or people seeping and popping out of bed and it's not fun to do that because it's not easy to do that.
Yeah, certain things that you're not used to drawing, like cars.
Yeah.
Unless you're really into cars and that's why you draw all the time.
Yeah, exactly. There's all sorts of things like that.
That Roger Dean, the artist that did all the album covers, he hates to draw the human figure.
Oh, he does?
Well, if you look at his stuff, it's a lot of, planets and otherworldly.
Yeah,
sometimes he might have some animals or cats or fish or something, but that album Yesterdays, that...
He drew people in that, didn't he?
Yeah, he had the two kids in the back, which I thought was pretty neat. I mean, I saw figures. I always liked them. But he didn't have too many figures and things, but if you read that book, Views, he was talking about he hates to draw the human figure, and he never thinks it turns out well. And I guess that cover, it was a cover that he was going to use and he discarded it. And then when Yes came to him about Yesterdays, it was basically old material that, they had never put out or, it was different versions of it. So he pulled out that painting and kind of reworked it again. But, and like I said, Frank Miller, when he was doing Sin City, Sin City, he was drawing cars, and he was kind of bragging that he had billions of them. Well, not billions, but he had a big number of die-cast, like matchbox cars, I guess he bought, or small cars. And he was using those as reference when he drew. And in Sin City, he had cars that you could see. He wasn't just slapping them together. He was thinking about them. And he says, you can do your entire career drawing superhero comics and never draw a car. And I thought, well, if I was doing it, I don't do cars very well.
Or a plane. Or inside a plane, you know. Mm-hmm. That's another one. That's like, you don't really...
Well, that's certain things, like if you have somebody go into a grocery store, you know, you have to draw products and this and that, and, you know, make them believable. And that's, again, that's some things I never think about, but some artists that I really disliked, they would draw stuff like that, and you could see they just weren't putting effort in it. And an artist I loved, and you never thought about it, I loved it because they drew products in a supermarket, but some of them would really put a lot into it, and you believed it, and you never thought about it.
Yeah.
You know, drawing incidental objects is...
not fun.
You know what? Calvin
it's
Hobbes.
Not the fun stuff.
Calvin Hobbes, that's one thing Charles Schultz in one of the collections brought up, was that Bill Watterson was really good at drawing end tables, you know, and lamps and, you know, little things. And I find I really enjoy that. I mean, and the story was never about end tables and lamps, but it's like he had simple little things, carpets and little paintings and stuff in it. And I thought, yeah, it's something I always enjoyed too, you know. And I don't know. It's things you don't think about.
I think what it is, it's even though you're getting a script, maybe some artists that are writers think about putting stuff in there that, say, an artist who's just a visualist wouldn't do. Like a writer might go, you know what? I'll make this end table more interesting because, you know, really, you know, I think it's going to be important or whatever. As an artist, will be like, yeah, I'm like line, doom, boom, 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 like that. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah. And since you're writing it, you want it to have more, you know, yeah, I mean, better.
Yeah.
You know, whereas you're just drawing it, you're just going through, okay, let me get this done. Let me get to the good stuff. Let me get to the close-up. Let me get to the superhero shot. Let me just go quickly get through this building and this, like, car and all this. Make it real small, and then everybody else is real big. You know?
Well, that's something else was, there was two things. I was listening to, I listened to the Word Balloon podcast that John Centris does, and he has Marty Pascoe on it sometimes. And they started talking about Joe Kubert, and was it Robert Kaniger that wrote all the stories for him? And they were talking about Kubert, that him and Kaniger were a really good team. They worked, and Kubert actually learned how to write by working with Bob Kaniger. But he was talking about him, and if I'm saying the writer's name wrong, I do apologize, but I think it was Bob Kaniger. But he said, Joe Kubert, even young, was so fast. And he says, Bob Kaniger got to be a better writer. And he said, Marty Pascoe was shocked at the amount of pages he could write. But he said, he had to keep feeding Joe Kubert. And he says, he would write, and I guess he rode the train into New York. And he says, he would write like 8 pages on the train. And Joe Kubert said, okay, I got these. You got any more? And so he passed the ones he wrote on the train. Then he'd be in the offices writing all day. And then, you know, him and Joe Kubert would, you know, talk about the stories and kind of plot them out together. And on the train back home, he'd write the rest of the story. So coming into work and coming out of work, he would write the stories for Joe Kubert there. And he started talking about, that's one thing with teams. He brought up Joe Kubert and Kaniger. They trusted each other. You know, I mean, they trusted what each other could do. And he said, when you see great teams, which we talk about all the time, he said, there's a level of trust between them. You know, Jim Aparo and Bob Haney, and, you know, Ross Andrew and Mike Esposito, you know, Rudy Lapik and Dan DiCarlo. And then at one point, Marty Pascoe brought up, which I agree with 100%, was Chris Claremont and John Byrne were a great team. They were one of my favorite teams. But he said there was no trust between those two, and that's why it ended up being, you know, such a, I hate to say it, but kind of what I saw, a hate fest, you know. And he said the reason why, there was they melded and had a good ability, and they really, it's some of my favorite comics. You know, the X-Men they did, Iron Fist they did, the Marvel team-ups, that Red Sonja Marvel team up, you know, God, they were just greatness. Star-Lord, but they said,
weren't like a good, but they didn't get along. Well, I mean,
well, they didn't
happens.
Trust each other, yeah.
But what do you mean by they didn't trust each other? Explain it to me.
Well, what they were saying was,
they didn't have the ability to, like, do something. Like, Byrne didn't have the ability to do something, say, draw it loosely.
No,
and let Terry Austin go to town on it.
No, I don't think it was ever an issue like that. The ones, all I know is from John Byrne's side. I saw him in Dallas in 82, and he was complaining about, in the X-Men, when they brought in Kitty Pryde, they took her to a dance studio. I guess since she was kind of a clumsy little girl. And she did dance before she joined the X-Men. Then she continued. Well, when Storm took her to the studio, there was a woman named Stevie, which is a dance instructor. And, you know, John Byrne drew her. And I don't know which one was saying what, but John Byrne drew her as a black woman. I mean, even with no color, you could see she was a black woman. She had the features. And one of them wrote notes on the side of the page about this was a black woman. And then John Byrne wrote the same thing. And it went back and forth, like neither one of them was reading what the other one said.
Yeah, she even had dreadlocks and stuff.
Yeah,
like that.
She had those beads in her hair like Bo Derek.
Yeah, yeah.
But John Byrne was complaining that he started writing his notes in ink, blue ink, non-photo blue ink. So, the fans, because I guess when the audience would complain about it, they could see in the original art that he did tell Chris this is what it should be. And there was times where in the X-Men, when they thought when they thought all the X-Men died, when they were Magneto's Volcano and the Beast and Jean Grey or Phoenix were stuck in Antarctic and the X-Men were in a savage land, both sides thought the other one was dead. And Storm was talking to Cyclops about it, and she said something about dealing with Jean. And then it had Scott Summers look right at the reader, and he had this long word balloon. Well, John Byrne in Dallas said that what he was supposed to say was just look up at the audience and says, "I didn't mourn for Jean." And Storm turned around like not knowing what to do and just left looking at Scott with, you know, like concern. And what he ended up writing was, he said, "I mourned for Hank, but I didn't really mourn for Jean. I don't know why." And then Storm turned around, "Maybe it's because she was no longer a girl and you're no longer a boy." Yeah, well, it didn't read that bad. That's what John Byrne was saying in 82, but it wasn't what they talked about. And John Byrne was arguing that...
Is he talking about Byrne and Claremont?
Yeah, on
okay,
the X-Men.
Byrne, not Byrne and Austin.
But he said on... what he was, that's the level of trust, was that John Byrne felt what they said, "I didn't mourn for Jean," and leave it at that, was more powerful and make the reader think. That's what he wanted. I guess that's what they were going to do, but later he was upset and he was yelling at Chris on the phone, and Chris said, "Well, that's just what I felt like writing." But
no,
Chris Claremont would change things, you know, just dying, and that was his prerogative. He would think, well, it'd work better this way. Part of it was that John Byrne wanted it one way, and sometimes Chris Claremont, I'm guessing, would be a little more fluid with things. And so a level of trust could be different things, but basically both sides have to kind of agree with what they're doing. And if one goes another direction, you just kind of go with them, you know. But
well, you can tell John Byrne's like an alpha dog anyway.
Yeah, well, he wants it his way. You know, he's that's the thing about it. It's like when he was retelling some of those old... They were republishing some of the Kirby and Lee Fantastic Fours in the 80s. And he would draw different panels in it. And that one story about John, Dr. Doom, his origin, when he messed up his face, you know, in university, and he says, "I'm hideous." Well, in the old stories, they never show it. It's just always in profile and silhouette. And John Byrne was at a convention explaining to people that it didn't mess his face up grotesquely. It was just a little scratch. But he had such an ego that he couldn't deal with it. So he thought he was hideous. Well, that's the beauty about the comics, is you let the reader fill in their own story, you know. Mm. You give enough, and then it's up to the reader to interpret. That's how John Byrne interpreted. That's kind of neat. I like that. But that's not, I thought it was horribly disfigured.
Me too.
Well, then John Byrne, you know, in the 80s when Marvel put it out, he drew a page, and it showed him with this little itty-bitty scratch. And I thought, well, okay, so he's, and some friend of mine was complaining, oh, once again, he's trying to take away our imagination. Well, that's just how he's put together. You shouldn't be retelling old stories that were so magical. But again, that's, John Byrne wants to tell you everything. He doesn't want it left to interpretation.
Yeah, he's basically struggling to put a stamp on something, so he just changes something. He doesn't know what to do. Well, I mean, you know, if you don't want, that's why you probably don't like to go see the Marvel movies, because they're really changing everything that you remember reading as a kid.
I don't mind. I mean, some of the things they do, I thought, well, that's a clever idea. I like how they did it. I'm really not interested in most. And again, to me, what's interesting is the form. It's the comic form. I like to see the drawings.
Yeah,
I like to see how they put it out.
Yeah, me too.
And, I mean, I love that. I like comic strips. I like all that stuff. I've seen some of the movies. I love The Rocketeer. But
yeah, that's...
But, I mean, you know...
A different world.
So... You know, some of the movies I might like.
And they did a lot of changes to that, too. One major one, but, you know.
Well, yeah, but that one didn't bother me much. I understood why, but, you know, and, yeah, they took out Doc Savage and kind of put in an Errol Flynn character as the protagonist.
No, Betty's not Betty, you know.
Yeah.
She's another character.
Yeah, but she was...
She's great in it, but, you know.
That didn't really bother me. But, anyway, all right, let's take a music break.
Music break. You have a music break song? You got a bad reputation. That's the word out on the town. It gets a certain fascination. But it can only bring you down. You better turn yourself around. Turn yourself around.
You can hear our most recent 20 episodes on iTunes. If you would like to hear our older episodes, you can find them on our blog. Just go to bunchofdorks.com and click on the Cyclops.
And that was Thin Lizzy with the song Bad Reputation from the album Bad Reputation, which is a record that I like a lot, and I suggest you go out and buy it out there in listener land. They've got a great, great fill in it.
Do you like it because you have a bad reputation?
Hell yeah. I got a worse reputation than them.
I never knew of any time. When did you have a bad reputation?
I don't know. Just there's a couple of women I could have you talk to that don't want to ever see me again. But no, I'm just kidding. I don't have a bad reputation. I'm just joking. But anyway, the late great Phil Lynott. So anyway, now back to our regularly scheduled programming.
Okay, one thing, you asked me a question that you caught me with my pants down. I couldn't answer. It was when the four of us were together. It was about comic books that, you know, had stories, just a single issue story. And I couldn't think of any at the time you asked me, but I bought one.
Oh, goody.
Usagi Jimbo 158.
Single issue story.
Well, the way Usagi Jimbo works, I did think of this. I've seen in the past, a lot of the stories are just a single issue story. Like one time it was him and that female character, Tomoe. And they were doing the Japanese tea ceremony. And, you know, when it finished, it was all silent. And finally, at the end, the last panel, he's walking away and he says goodbye, you know, and that was it. Then they go into big epics like Grasscutter, which is my favorite. Well, in these issues, they have like three issue story arcs. And the last one was about a tapestry in a Buddhist temple. And it became a kind of a detective story. Well, after that, there's this story. It's a Japanese tradition, but basically he's walking on the road. There's these There's these bandits, and they stop this man and his elderly mother, who's poor. There's a drought in the area. And so they basically take them, and they're just taking what food they have. Everybody's starving. And they're trying to get to this mountain, and then Usagi Jimbo, you know, shows up, stops the bandits. And then he says, do you mind if I go with you? And they're like, you know, they're kind of embarrassed, the samurai with these peasants. But he traveled with them and found out. And it starts talking about this Japanese tradition, which, you know, as an American, I learned about. And the story unfolds, it's good, but it's a single issue story. But that's what they always do. He has a story arc, usually three issues. Sometimes in cases like Grasscutter, it goes on. But a lot of times it's just a simple one issue story. And it's still published all the time.
But they're not always one. They're always arcs. Usually they're arcs, right?
Well, I mean, sometimes, but there's times where it's just single issues.
That's issue 158?
Yeah.
Dark Horse is printing 158 issues of it?
Uh-huh.
Wow, I didn't realize that.
But
that's a long run.
Yeah, and let's see, what was it? Mirage did 16 issues in color. And then Fantagraphics, I don't know how many they did. The only thing with the Fantagraphics issues, I have some of them. I bought the first five issues that came out, but they were $2 a piece, which was a lot of money then. And he only did half the issue. And the second half was people he knew, I guess, out of Hawaii. They were small comic guys. But those stories, to me, I really didn't like them. And sometimes somebody do one that was nice, but half of an issue that you really didn't like, make it half the size and charge $1. And then when I started collecting them later, I thought, I wish I would have bought those issues. Well, a friend of mine had a friend that had a comic store that had some old issues. So through her, I bought like three or four of them. And I thought, I realized why I didn't like the Fantagraphics issues. Some of them, Sakai did all of it. But I found when you buy the trades, they're a little tiny bit smaller than the actual comic book, you know, as far as dimensions. But it's all Stan Sakai and no filler.
This has an art assist on it.
Huh?
There's an art assistant. He's got an art assistant now here. Jennifer Kagawa.
That's his wife.
Oh, okay. Well, she's the art assistant, too.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah, she's an artist. All right. One
number two. More of Valerian, right?
Yeah, The Wrath of Hypsis. This is the fourth, you know, talk about story arcs. Last time we talked, I was telling Al, and he was interested because Valerian went back to the 1980s, him and Loreline. And this is the last of the stories of that arc. And I'll tell you, the other ones, I told you, I didn't really know what was going on with them. I had one of those volumes in French back in the 90s, and my friend Juan read it. Juan liked the English copies I had, but when he read that one, he was just so disinterested. And I said, what do you think? And he said, he was telling me about it, but he seemed disinterested. I bought those when they started putting them out in English. I liked the art, the story. I couldn't quite tell exactly what they were doing while they were back in the 1980s. But the world they drew and built was kind of lush. This one finishes the whole storyline, and I'll tell you, I loved it. It explains why they had to find that water alien guy who turns out to be a strong character. You start understanding why they came back to the 1980s. And they bring up some kind of poetic, philosophical things at the end. That's why I would like Pete Christian's stories. But when this finished, basically, I guess it's a different direction that's going to keep going on. Because the whole universe that was in those older issues in the future is changed. And I had read about this, that one reason why was they were upset, and there was a lawsuit against Lucasfilms about Star Wars because they thought that, you know, they were taking everything from them. As I always say, I see where they're coming from. I can see, you know, I don't know if Lucas is doing it, but
Disney's going to be who they're the one that already suing now, not Lucas.
But, well, that's all over and done with. But basically what they had said was that they were taking all their ideas about the future, so they were going to change the direction. And, I mean, he still has a spaceship. It's still him and Loreline, some of the aliens. But I guess they're going to be now based in the 1980s in the present day with some future technology. I thought, that's gutsy, you know.
And this book was drawn in the 80s, right, or no?
Yeah, I think this one was originally in the 80s. I'll tell you, I'm loving it. And
is he still drawn new today?
I don't know.
Okay.
I think that they started coming out less frequently. This, 1985, this came out. They're still coming out, and I guess because of the movie, they've amped up. It used to be they put out two a year, and now they're putting out either three a year or four a year. Because all of a sudden, they're starting to... Well, as you see down here in the bottom, they got four
new
of them.
Ones?
Yeah, well,
coming
for
soon.
Us,
coming
for
soon,
us,
yeah.
Not France. But I guess I'm hoping that when the movie comes out, the movie won't suck and there'll be some interest in the comics. And maybe the comics will be available for a wider audience. I'm telling you, it's one of my favorite comics. And reading these stories that came out in the 80s, no backslide. I'm still enjoying it. And, when I finished this one, I was so excited, thinking, man, everybody's got to read this. So, anyway, pick it up, read it. But I've never seen it in any store.
Not even in Barnes & Noble?
No, I've never seen them anywhere.
Yeah, that's funny. It's like it's if a tree falls in the forest, you know? It's I've never seen them either until you brought them out. I'll tell you the truth. I've seen the Mobius books, but I never saw those before.
Yeah, so. New Mobius just came out, Adina.
Oh,
Dark Horse is putting out a series of Mobius books, and they're going to do the series, but they're hardbacks. They're kind of thick, and I'll be honest, I was disappointed because they look small. You know, Dark Horse, when they printed the Mobius stuff before, they were like mini comics. They were like Japanese manga size or something. I'm like, well, you can't do that. Well, that's one thing we always talk about was when Dark Horse finally got it. And they were bringing material over. Some of its material has already been published. Some of it we've never seen. Adina, Epic, published a lot of it, but they didn't finish it. And they're, the dimensions of the hardbacks, the hardback looks nice, the design and everything. But I was disappointed thinking, it's smaller than the European versions. Scott Connor was talking about it. He was a little upset. But then he looked it up, and I guess Dark Horse said that the artwork is printed the same size. It's just that we're not going to have the big white borders that I guess the European volumes show.
Okay.
So we'll see. It came out on sale like Wednesday or Thursday last week. And all of a sudden, comic stores in Portland and Chicago and New York were posting pictures of the hardback. We got it. We got it. And people have been posting it that I got in the mail. I've got it on a wish list on an online seller, but I haven't picked it up yet, but I'm wanting to.
Huh? What else you got?
That's it. It's your turn.
Well, I got to go get the book, so do you want to take a break, or you want to, like, well, you talk while I go get books. How about that?
That's good. I'm talking about something we don't have any subject on right now.
That's right, ladies and gentlemen. Step right up. It's time for Pulpalooza again. That's what I got.
But we have no song.
We have no song, but maybe soon we will. So, in my hands here, I have two stacks of comic books with, like, classic greatness of the comic book historical wonder. I'll have you pull a book out, and hopefully we find something to talk about.
All right. Pulpalooza.
Pulpalooza. There you go. King of the Congo. Thunder, drawn by Bob Powell.
Okay, this is AC Comic.
AmeriComics reprints.
AC. They were from the 80s, right?
Yeah. The books are from the 50s, yeah. Remember, the first Thunder was that beautiful...
Frazetta,
which I think I can get to pretty quickly, but that's... Most of the issues were done by Bob Powell. And... don't have it available right now, so we can talk about that one. The first issue was beautiful, and these are great, too. Bob Powell, of course, worked through the 40s, worked with Eisner, did a lot of stories on his own. In the 50s, he came to be prominence. He worked for, like, I don't know, every comic book company. Bob Powell was basically a studio, kind of. You know, he had, like, assistants, and, you know, he would lay out the story, but they would all ink it, and he would draw the faces, and therefore lots of comic book stories were being published by him. And, as your typical jungle... You know, yeah. Adventure, which was very popular back then.
Was that Bill Black that did AC Comics?
Bill Black still does AmeriComics. Yeah, he still puts them out. I think it's mostly reprints now.
Hmm.
He does the deal where he takes the book and bleaches the color out.
Oh yeah, like Greg Teaxton.
Bleaches the color out, and then I think he actually embellishes it a little bit. Like, he adds gray tone.
Yeah,
and,
which is nice.
And maybe fills in some of the art if the bleach hit too hard or something. And yeah, it's definitely, like, he's puts his stamp on it. Teaxton pretty much leaves it alone. He adds to it, but, yeah, it's always nice. I have a few issues of those. Those were published by, I think, Magazine Enterprises was the name of the company. And
I don't know, Gardner Fox wrote these stories.
Yeah, Gardner Fox wrote. I think Gardner Fox, Tom Gill, I think they say might be the most prolific, but Gardner Fox might be second. As far as writing
stories.
Yeah,
well, he's one of my favorites. I love Gardner Fox. I loved the stories. I loved all the stuff he wrote for DC and those strange adventures and everything. I always loved him. You know, I've never bought one AC comic. I remember...
I remember
when they were out. I mean, it wasn't a hay thing, but even when I pulled this out, I was disappointed seeing the cover, because this, to me, kind of looks...
The car alarm's going off.
Okay. It kind of looks amateurish to me. But when you open it up, that is absolutely beautiful.
He's a wonderful artist, man.
Bob Powell was the one George Tuska popped.
Yeah,
because
he was hitting on some that female assistant in the Iger Studios or Eisner Studios or whatever.
Yeah, Bob Powell, is he the one that way back you had that 1950s horror book? Was that him?
Yeah. That one over there somewhere down there. Where there's a picture of him on the back.
Yeah, like another mask. The cover was mask, and then the end papers, I think, were mask, and the back picture was his picture, and he just looked like a pretty easygoing, nice guy. But,
he was younger in the 40s. Yeah. I guess he was hitting, and Bob Powell, I think Tuska just got sick of him and got up and belted him.
Yeah, Tuska was always quiet, but that was in Will Eisner's The Dreamer.
That's a book, The Dreamer.
And Bob Powell, I'm didn't seem like anybody I'd want to be around.
But he was a studio man. I mean,
yeah. Well, when Will Eisner left Jerry Iger's studio, he took the spirit with him, and he brought a Bob Powell, and I can't remember the other guy.
Oh, yeah, I know who the other guys are. I can't think of them right now.
But he took his two favorite artists. That was the deal. He could take the spirit and those two artists, and he created his own. But I'll tell you, these...
Klaus Nordling, maybe. I don't know. I know Bob Powell did. One of them did Lady Luck, and the other one did... I forget what the other character was. Anyway.
But this... Their choice, golly, these are great. Panels are great. Bob Powell was really the real deal.
He was inventive, man. Yeah. He really was, and like I said, the assistants did a lot of the work, but Powell made, you know, did the faces, so, hey, it's Bob Powell, you know.
I like the line work on it, too.
Yeah, Howard Nostrand and stuff like
that. Oh, really?
They did a lot of work for Harvey in the 40s, in the 50s, and that was Bob was.
And Howard Nostrand drew for Crack Magazine.
Yeah, he sure did. Yeah, he sure did. He did some of those TV adaptations or whatever. Yeah.
But their choice of the gray tones, it's something that's kind of lost now, because like they got birds in the foreground. The birds are gray tone. The background's a gray tone. But good choices. This is the cover doesn't reflect what you see on the inside. I would have bought these in a heartbeat and would have been happy. I'm kind of disappointed I didn't get them now. And what I really like is, besides that, on the front, inside front cover is Buster Crabbe.
Look at the back.
King of the Con. Yeah, and I was looking in the back.
On the back, too, right?
It's a whole section. It has all of his stuff. A King of the Pirates of the High Seas, Casper the Lion Man, King of the Jungle, of course, Flash Gordon.
Tarzan.
Jungle Man. He played Billy the Kid. And I'm going to tell you something.
Is he from Oklahoma?
Is he?
I don't know. I'm asking you.
That'd be nice. One thing is to see, Buster Crabbe was a cowboy. It's pretty good. Errol Flynn made a really sissy cowboy.
Whenever he was a swashbuckler, though.
Yeah, he was a great... I love Errol Flynn. He's a great swashbuckler. But every time I watch these cowboy movies, I'm so embarrassed.
You don't like the kid? They die with their boots on?
I don't know if I ever saw that. But some of those movies, I'm thinking, God, just how sissy can you look? And he had that big flashing smile and...
Yeah, cowboys are rougher looking.
Yeah, he was just horrifying. He just looked like a... Cool. Yeah, this is nice. Yeah, this is a nice book. I read it was 250. What year did this come out?
It's got to be 80s. 80, early 80s, maybe.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, you should see his newer reprint books are in the $20 range.
Yeah. I don't see the date on this. I remember when he was out. They were all in the 80s, but... Like I said, I bought Usagi Jimbo, and it was $2 an issue, which a lot of those books were $2 an issue.
Let me see.
But $2.50.
Hit the bottom. It doesn't say anything. Yeah, it says copyright 1989.
Okay, well, that was the later 80s. So.
Yeah, printed in Florida, yeah.
That wasn't really any more expensive than the other books. Again, the cover, and a lot of the AC comics, I didn't care for the covers.
Maybe that was it.
But I remember he did Femme Force.
Those were kind of like, you know, jokey or whatever, you know. So.
And I think when AC Comics came out, they had Perez covers.
Did they?
It was kind of, I mean, it was different artists, but I remember it was kind of exciting because all of a sudden we had Pacific Comics, Eclipse Comics, and...
First Comics.
Yeah, First Comics. And the thing was... I remember Eclipse was around. I'd read about Sable and Starlog magazine and stuff, and I'm like, "Well, where can you find this? I never saw Sable." And then when Jim Starlin left Epic Illustrated doing that Metamorphos Odyssey, he had another one called The Price, and Eclipse put it out. Well, that's nice. Where is that at? And I was reading about Marshall Rogers is doing Coyote. Where can you find it? Eclipse is doing it, but they had a big magazine. I never saw any of these. And it wasn't until all of a sudden the newer publishers, Pacific, came out, and then all of a sudden you started finding Eclipse, and they were easy to find. But in the past, just because you're an independent publisher doesn't mean everybody's going to carry you. I never found them in Oklahoma.
Well, Diamond carried them, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, but the store I went to never took a chance, I guess.
Later, well, would they let you look through previews?
At the time, no. I never knew it. This is way back in the early.
Yeah.
But another store opened up in Oklahoma, and they had the AC Comics. And again, my buddy Britt came up from Dallas. We were at that one store, and they had the AC Comics. And, you know, I never bought one, but it's kind of exciting to see more publishers come out. And George Perez had done a cover for one. And Britt just laughed because he loved George Perez. You know, we all did. But he says, well, I finally found a Perez cover that I hate. And I said, what's wrong with it? There wasn't anything wrong with it. Well, Jim Steranko was supposed to do the cover of that issue, and something came up, and he didn't do it. I don't know why, deadlines or something. And so they got George Perez to do it. So Britt was joking that, you know, he was really excited to see more. Steranko was always his favorite, besides Kirby. But I just remember they were getting some of the bigger name, you know, comic artists at the time to do covers. But I never, you know, I don't know what the issues were. I just remember they had a bunch. But I never saw that. The inside isn't, the outside's not a reflection of the inside, though.
I mean, the outside's okay. I mean, I don't mind. That's probably the original cover of the book. It doesn't look like it's a panel. I mean, it could be a panel. I don't know, but
it doesn't look.
Oh, you know what? You know what it is too. Bill Black reinked it because it's Powell and Black. I'm wondering if Bill Black just redrew a Bob Powell panel and made it as a cover. I don't know. Well, anyway.
All
right. Grab another, buddy.
All right.
There we go. This is DC Comics.
Now, this one I've never heard of.
Sinister House.
Can you face the secrets of Sinister House, number 6, from DC? This is back when they were 20 cents. It was in the early 70s.
Who the hell's in that?
1972.
Wow. We're merely lads.
Yeah. Yeah, some more lads than others. I'm trying to see who drew this first part. Alfredo Cal, not this first page.
First, that looks like Kaluta from here.
I want to say it does look like Kaluta, but I don't know if it is. Yeah, it must be.
Let me take a look at it. Let's see if I can... Yeah, oh yeah, it's Mike Kaluta. Oh yeah. Yeah, this is one of my infamous... No, not enough Bugs got to this. This might be one of the ones that Bugs got to.
The Spines. Yeah, well, I have a lot of DC's comics at the time. The Spines came out. They were thicker at the time. But
yeah, I think Bugs might have gotten to this one, too. But yeah, the first
two... What is the cover of that? I like that cover. Is that...
Kaluta.
Oh, okay. Still Kaluta.
Yeah, this is Kaluta. Yeah, still. Why isn't he not signing them? I don't know. But anyway. Yeah, this is Kaluta. The first two pages are Kaluta. And then we get a...
Alfredo Alcala.
Alfredo Alcala story, which is great. And see, all these books that I have without a spine, I should pull them all to the side and then send them to a binder. That way they can bind them all as one. I don't have to worry about like the stupid
bug-eating
spine or whatever.
That's a good idea, actually.
The second story was by Ed Ramos. I don't know who he is, but probably a Filipino.
It looks good.
And the third one was by Bill Drought and 40s guy. Now, the third story... Story by Bob Kaniger. I'm wondering if this is a reprint, but I don't think it is because the people look like... Well, here, you take a look at it. The people look like they're in modern times. Sinister House started off... I'm pretty sure the deal of this book was... Originally, it started off as a gothic romance book called The Secret House of Sinister Love, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And then when that kind of died off or didn't hit, then they turned it into just Sinister House or whatever. And then... It was just little horror stories or whatever, which I always loved or whatever. But yeah, that's Bill Drought, who was around in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah, he's somebody I don't know, but I don't know. It doesn't look like an old. I mean, well, now it looks like an old story, but this looked like it was drawn at the time, new.
Ah, yeah, you think you're right. Yeah, the people have modern look to them. Yeah.
At the time, what I like is how they have the witch drawn by another artist in the panel there with the bird. It looks good though.
Yeah.
I guess it wasn't originally intended to be there.
No, I don't know why he didn't draw the witch or whatever, but maybe he might have and they didn't like it. I don't know.
I think he just drew the story and then they always had those framing sequences.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was reading about Bernie Wrightson. That was his favorite thing. You know, he did a lot of covers and you think he loved the covers. But he said the covers were okay, but what he loved was the framing sequences, the introduction, like you do two or three pages. And he said that was the one he really cut his teeth in. He loved doing those where, you know, there was a setup and you didn't have to draw a whole story and worry about it. You had to draw the cover.
day or two and you're done. You know?
He loved those. But, I mean, I guess part of it was, to me, it's like drawing a sketchbook. Like, you can kind of draw what you want, not worry about it, you know. that is. I never thought of that.
There, grab another.
That is nice. I'm not familiar with that book.
Yeah, probably went 20 issues, maybe, or whatever.
All right, you ready?
I'm ready.
Korak, Son of Tarzan.
Oh, yeah, probably Don. Probably Dance the Eagle, maybe, or Russ Manning.
Again, Gold Key, sometimes the stories that had painted covers that always got me, like the Star Treks.
I believe the artist is George Wilson, who did a lot of the covers. It looks like Russ Manning. Oh, no, I think it's, you know who I think it is? Doug Wilde.
I would just say this does look really nice.
Doug Wilde.
One thing, it's got the Al Williamson kind of thin lines that he started using later.
Yeah.
I do like kind of a bolder look, but these drawings are second to none. It starts out, Tarzan's walking around with, it looks like a spear or a bow, in an African village. And the people, they're drawn really nice looking, but they're African people in African dress. And it's spot on. Even though they're drawn as Africans, they're drawn very effectively.
Wait a minute. I'm saying something different.
Some of the faces remind me of Russ Manning.
Yeah, some of the faces do look like Russ
Manning. But the finishes do not.
No, it's definitely like, it's definitely, oh man, this is a weird combination. I'm going to have to look this up. I'm wondering if this is Russ Manning inking over Doug Wilde, because that looks like Doug Wilde to me, because it's loose and but like you said, that face looks like Russ Manning, and that looks like Russ Manning. I'm going to have to look this up. Talk about it a little. I think we're going online. What issue of Korak is it? Let me see if I can find it.
I don't see a number.
Oh, yeah, open it, look in the front, the Indicia, yeah.
December 1966. That's when my brother was born.
Brother's born December?
No, but in 66.
Oh, okay.
But, that's really nice. You know, one thing.
Korak 15. What did you say?
Korak Son of Tarzan 15. 1966. Russ Manning, I had some of his books. I had a Mangus Robot Fighter. And I've seen his Tarzan work. I really like Russ Manning a lot, but I didn't realize who he was. Steve Rude took a lot of Russ Manning with him, along with other artists.
Oh, yeah.
But I actually really enjoy seeing some of Russ Manning's work. Now, he did the Tarzan comic strip in the newspaper, right?
Manning did, yeah.
For a while.
Now, was that issue 15? I'm sorry.
Yeah, 15.
Oh, I got it right in. Grant, whenever you like got a book and you don't know who it is, type in the name of the book, the number, And afterwards, the letters GCD, and that's a Grand Comics database, and it could be a pretty big help to you as far as knowing who, what the details are. Well, that's funny. You know what? It says Doug Wilde and Warren Tufts. So there you go. Warren Tufts, who was, he did mostly strips or whatever, but... I thought it was, and on the back, the last story is a Jesse Marsh story, so that's something to look forward to when you get to the back of it, too. But, yeah, Doug Wilde and Warren Tufts. Let me see if I can find a little bit about Warren Tufts here.
See, I'm not familiar with Warren Tufts. Yeah, this is nice. This is really nice, even towards the end. But my goodness, when they draw Tarzan's face, it looks like Russ Manning.
It does look like Russ Manning.
And the way Doug Wilde drew it sometimes reminds me of Dan Spiegel.
Warren Tufts is basically, that's a book, Casey Ruggles, which was a Western book.
Yeah, I remember that.
That's him, yeah. Yep, that's his big deal. He says on TV he lent his voice, and artistic talent to Captain Fathom, which is one of those synchro box for the weird, where people's Challenge of the Super Friends, all sorts of things like that. In 82, he was killed in a car crash. Oh, God. Of an airplane of his own design that he was piloting. Oof. Anyway, great artist, man. So there you go. There's your answer. We thought it. I still it looks like Russ Manning to me, but you know what?
These guys,
Jim Vancouver or whatever, these guys are good. I mean, they're good spotters, but it does look like Russ Manning to me.
I think maybe they were using that as a model because he must have been doing the comic strip at the time.
And you know, Russ Manning did do a lot of these Korax and Tarzan books around that time.
But when they're drawing, oh, it is Korax. I thought it was Tarzan. But when they draw Korax, he's inked differently than the other characters. The other characters, it looks like Doug Wiley finished everything, and then the other guy just kind of went in and inked Tarzan and maybe redrew his face.
It says heads by Warren Tufts.
Oh, there you go. So that's
it. He drew inked the heads.
But that's, it looks like it's just Tarzan's or Korax's head.
Yeah, probably. Who knows?
Well, that's what
the editor probably. That's like John Romita did that all the time.
We're talking about John Romita always did it.
And there was an article I read where he said, "Hey, don't blame me. That was Stan." I wasn't the one who wanted to go in there and rechange everybody's face. It was some.
Well, and DC did that to Jack Kirby on Superman. You know,
Al Faustino and Murphy Anderson redrew it. That was Carmen Infantino.
Yeah, but those actually were kind of horrifying when you look at it.
My buddy Danny had an original page, and it was kind of weird because you could see the paste up. And I never noticed it before, and I was like, holy crap, that's a paste up of... I was trying to get him to rip it open and see what the original, but he didn't want to rip the page.
Oh, yeah, no blame. Shame on you, man. Yeah, and the second story is John of the Kalahari, Fiery Passage, and it is drawn by Jesse Marsh.
Great Jesse Marsh.
I never heard of, and after Al turned me on to him, I found that I love him.
Did like 170 issues straight of Tarzan, man.
You know, one thing about Jesse Marsh, he had a fine touch. I mean, when I say that, the drawings sometimes were loose and, you know, really thick lined, but I don't know, there's a charm, an honesty to his work.
I think that's a good word, an honesty, yeah. And he was great at drawing animals and stuff.
Yeah, he drew animals and stuff.
It's almost like that's what interested him more than, you know, human beings or
but
whatever.
But, you know, like when he draws the African people here,
He gives them character.
He gives them character, and like he follows the styles. Like, you know, the lady's got a headdress and the clothes, but they're not just stock people. And like when he did the John Carter work, which is some of my favorite.
Yeah, that's great stuff.
Like when he did Deja Thoris, she looked like an ancient Peruvian or something, like a South American. I mean,
it's like he looked in the book maybe or something.
Like he didn't just draw. And when I say this, I love these, but like, you know, how Marvel Comics always drew Deja Thoris. She looked like an ancient woman you'd see in National Geographic. Like he took something to root it in.
Yes.
But he kind of made it otherworldly at the same time. I've always liked him. Fruit of the giant herb, and it's bananas.
There you go.
Yeah, well, this is a nice issue, 12 cents.
Yeah, George Wilson is the guy who did the cover. He did a lot of these. He did the majority of them. There's other artists, too, but that's like the guy who did the, you know, the main one. We're going to do one more?
Let's do one more.
All right, go ahead and
this is great, back yourself great, out. Great fun. Okay.
All right.
I'm sorry, y'all.
You know nothing about this book.
This is a king, nothing. King size special, Tower of Shadows number 1, 25 cents.
Oh, man.
From Marvel Comics Group.
Don't you remember, like, in the early 70s, this was Marvel's horror book. You should see the artist in that. You're going to, like...
Who did the cover of this?
That looks like it's a little bit of Neil Adams and a little bit of Romita.
Well, it's just signed Romita.
Okay, that's just Romita.
It does, yeah.
Oh, you're gonna love this book. Well, the first one's what, Don Heck?
But this isn't typical Don Heck.
This is him at his, what he's good at.
Witch Hunt, written by Roy Thomas, Don Heck artist, Dan Adkins, embellisher.
Yeah, Marvel, like, started out in the early 70s doing, like, brand new horror stories. Kirby did one. Adams did one. Buscema did them. They're probably in this book, for all I know.
Yeah, this is 71.
That's what I remember, anyway.
This is 1971, which I didn't really see Marvel Comics at the time.
Really? They weren't in the newsstands around that time?
Not in the stores I went to. They were in other stores, but not in areas. The reason this looks so different is it said Dan Adkins is the embellisher, so he really...
Oh, it's Dan Adkins inking...
it said embellished by Dan Adkins.
Yeah, that means Don Heck...
He finished, he did a lot more work. Yeah. Some of these panels look like Gene... This looked like Gene Colan. I love Dan Adkins. That's nice. Man, there's a lot of stories
in there. That's Neil Adams.
Yeah, One Hungers...
That's a good, it's like a Blob story.
Oh, he wrote it and drew it. You know, they showed the Blob on the...
They're showing it now on TCM. Or they
yeah.
Are.
Yeah, that's what I saw it today before I came over. I've never seen it.
You never saw the Steve McQueen? Wow.
They had another one in the...
It's all night, all throughout tomorrow and Monday.
In the mid-70s, CBS late at night used, had one called The Blob, but it was done in the 70s.
You were The Blob.
Oh, was that what? It was so... And I remember every time
it's
The Blob...
It's a comedy.
Yeah.
Larry Hagman is involved in it.
And every time The Blob would go by, you'd make that sound. Yeah. And so every time they talk about The Blob and Steve McQueen, I'm like, God, that movie was awful. He was in that?
That's a Larry Hagman version of it. Oh, man, the CBS...
So it was Beware the Blob. It was a separate...
It was a sequel, like 10 years later.
Oh, it was horrible. It was so stupid.
20 years later. I meant the CBS late night movie was so great. They used to play all sorts of weird horror movies and stuff like that.
All right, we used to watch it, and I'd go to school, and everybody would be talking about it and laughing about it. I remember on Beware the Blob, there was a guy sitting there watching TV, and the Blob sneaks up in his house and rolls doing all that. Next thing you know, the guy's in his easy chair.
The Blob eat like a little kitty cat in the beginning or something like that, like a little cat or something.
It just looked like kind of like a Jell-O balloon to me. And then, but the Steve McQueen, everybody said, I didn't remember him in that movie.
He's in the first one.
Well, I saw it today, and I'll tell you, I was waiting for the cable guy,
it's
and I'm
fun.
Thinking, it was fun. It was a good movie, you know. I mean, it was a really good movie.
Yeah, it was fun, man. Like when they're in a movie theater and the Blob like starts going through or whatever. Oh, yeah, I remember when I bought this.
I'll tell you something. This opening page, when I saw that, this looks more like Alex Toth or...
I know. You know what you mean, yeah.
It doesn't look like Neil Adams. It has the dynamic panels that he does, but, I mean, it does not. And then all of a sudden, the next page, more Neil Adams looking. And then when you get to this, my God, this is stock Neil Adams to no end. That's really strange how the first page... Yeah, it's like a Blob. No, and then we got a third story. This is
Sal the Sandler?
Look out, Wyatt. Automation's going to get your job. Gary Friedrich wrote it, and John Buscema penciled it. John Verputin inked it.
Great anchor.
He was a great, especially on Kirby. I liked him.
Yeah, he did do a great job on Kirby. Yeah, that's prime Buscema, man. 1970?
Yeah, yeah.
69, maybe?
This is Buscema when he was putting everything into it. All right. This sounds like an old one. It says, a truly tender tale, touchingly told to you by Stan Lee and John Buscema, inking Don Heck.
Don Heck inking John Buscema. That's an interesting combination. Mm-hmm. See, that Gravekeeper, that was like them trying to do Uncle Creepy or something like that. You know, he was the host of the...
But Uncle Creepy was long gone by the time this
started. Creepy was around in 1970. Are you kidding me?
Uncle, I'm sorry. I'm thinking of the Crypt Keeper.
Oh, yeah. He was long gone. She was long gone. Or he was long gone or whatever. Oh, yeah. These guys, they were doing these at the same time as they brought back romance book. Well, there's Romita.
This is Johnny Craig.
Doesn't that face in the background look like Romita?
Yeah, absolutely looks like Romita. Stan Lee, editor, Johnny Craig, writer and artist, Artie Simic. It's from Beyond the Brink.
So they got Romita to redraw the woman's face.
You
incredible.
Think? Do you
let
think?
Me take a look at it because it's upside down.
It does look like
Romita. They got her to redraw her face. God, Stan.
Can you find the other copy of it? Does you think one exists?
I don't think one exists of the pencil page or anything like that. I'll look, but I don't think. Cause I think when he put a stamp on it, that's it. Done. It's nice, though. Romita doesn't ink the whole story, does he?
No, it's all...
Wait a minute. It is Romita. They screwed up.
It says Johnny Craig, writer and artist.
No. I think... Let me take a look at it, because I think this is a screw-up. Because everywhere I look is John Romita. I bet you it was Johnny Craig pencils and Romita inking it. Because take a look at it really well. I think it might be Johnny Craig's layouts. But every page you look at is John Romita inking.
It looks well.
I'm staking my... again, I'll look it up and I'll... But I'm pretty sure it's Johnny Craig penciling it and they didn't give credit to Johnny Romita. Because maybe it's Johnny and Johnny, you know what I mean? But yeah.
Or maybe Romita didn't want credit for it.
Yeah, that's John Romita, yeah. And then the last one's an old Ditko reprint from the 50s, probably. Early 60s, probably.
I opened the door to nowhere.
You know, I never realized. I read the other day that Ditko never really stopped working for Charlton. He always did other work on the side while he was working for Marvel. Even when he was doing Spider-Man, he was still doing like a Charlton story here and there.
I never knew that.
Yeah, I never knew either. Somebody wrote it the other day, and then I looked, and I saw there was some Captain Adams, and it said 65, and I'm going like, wasn't this around the same time as Spider-Man? Wasn't he leave or what? You know, and then I find other stories, and I go, wait a minute, this is 63 or whatever?
Why was he doing
Conga, whatever, money. You know, it was more money for him, you know. I think he liked working for Charlton because it was freedom. He just could do whatever the hell he wanted.
Well, that's what I was heard, was that he liked Charlton because the rates weren't as good, but he could do what he wanted.
He could do what he wanted. He wasn't getting, like, told, like, by Stan, hey, you know, make him better looking or do this or do that, you know. So, anyway, yeah, this is Tower of Shadows. This is the King Size Special reprints of the first year of the book. These early 70s Marvel horror books, the Kirby story is not in this one, but it was a fine story,
too. That whole book is chock full, and there's not one bad thing in it.
No, it's a beat-up quarter copy, but I'll take it. You know,
I would take it.
I'll take it.
You know, one thing, though, when you're talking about Stan Lee, I have to say that I think he made all the right choices.
I think so, too.
I think Stan Lee was a great editor.
I think you're right.
And
a great salesman too.
Yeah, and a great salesman. But I mean, all the things you're talking about, that was an editor. He understood how to put a book together and how to make it better. And I understand Steve Ditko getting upset, and I like the Blue Beetle, you know, stories he did for, but those aren't as good as the Doctor Strange and Spider-Man stories he did for Marvel.
Yeah, they're probably not as memorable, but I still enjoy them.
I'm going to say that I liked them. I love the Blue Beetle, you know. I like the Question, and I like the designs of them.
I think if the Blue Beetle would have been brought over to Marvel, he would have liked it. Maybe we would have both liked it better. Well,
that's what I mean. I think Stan Lee made the right decisions. You know, I think, I don't know,
I think what Stan Lee did was he was at the right place at the right time with the right guy, Jack Kirby, who kind of created a new way of drawing comics. And in a sense, not a new way, but it just worked really well. And everybody said, okay, here's what we got to do. Let's make books that are really in your face, and I'm going to sell them, and we're going to take it from here. And they've changed the world of comics, basically, you know.
You know,
for the better or for the worse, some people think they're not for the better. There are people that don't care for those books, those 60s Marvels, you know. They'd rather go back to whatever, Dells or whatever, you know, or DCs. There's some people that go, oh, well, I like the Marvels, but the DCs were more fun to me, you know what I mean?
Well, you know, everybody's got their own thinking.
That's right.
Some of them I love. What I didn't like is that eventually Marvel started, you know, flooding the market and putting out much stock. But, I mean, those old stuff in the 60s?
I think they started flooding the market when they got freed of the shackles of distribution from, you know, DC bringing them down.
And that's it. And before that, I'm going to say that I don't like what Marvel did, but I understand why they did it. And I think what DC did was unforgivable.
You mean when they were shackling them to
Yeah, they're
going to
let Marvel put out 8 books? Of course, at the same time, those 8 books, maybe that was it. They concentrated and made them better. Maybe it wouldn't have been as good.
Well, because all those 8 books had Jack Kirby stamps written all over them. Not exactly, but a lot of them did. I mean, you know the superhero books? People were telling the artists, hey, make it more powerful, you know, make it more Kirby-ish or whatever. And it made sense because it was completely different from DC. DC was Kurt Swan, Murphy Anderson, Andrew Esposito. And they were great. You know, I love Bruno Premiani. I love Bob Brown. I love all those guys. But at the time, they also looked a little more like, you know, I don't know, the word isn't boring, but the Marvel stuff seemed to be a little edgier. You know what I mean?
Well, it was counterculture.
Kind of.
That's the thing with college students.
Kind of.
You know, Walt Simons had talked about it, but I've heard other people say it, that he read comics as a kid and he kind of went away from them. Everybody tends to do it. And then when he was in college, he saw Thor. And then he found Fantastic Four, and he said, I started reading comics again. He says, and I bought all the Marvel comics. He says, at that time you could do that. There's only 8 a month. But, I mean, I have a feeling. Sometimes you have to limit your options. You know, when computers first came out, I still remember that all of a sudden nobody's getting anything done because everybody's tweaking little things. I mean, the the options in these programs are limitless of what you could do. And this one seasoned professional I worked with, he said, the thing is, the computers are limitless. You have to limit your options. And that's one thing we talk about old movies. Sometimes
you can't, more.
Yeah, you can't do all the CGI special effects, which sometimes I like. But the thing is, if you limit things and change it, there's a magic to it, you know. One thing I want to say, I was looking this up when I was talking about Jack Kirby. I listen to a lot of podcasts, like, I don't know which one this came from, but I listened to one about, you know, books. These writers come on and talk, and I think that's where it came from. I also listened to the New York Library podcast, which they have writers come on and speak. But this guy, his name is Stuart Lee, and I don't think he ever read comics. And somehow they got to talk about Jack Kirby. And he'd read those old Jack Kirby Fantastic Fours, as everyone should. But it said, Fantastic Four was another dimension, and he always did collages, which fascinated him. And he said, this was a guy who was working within the rules of genre, and he somehow made children look at abstract art. Yeah. And I thought, you know, that's well said. there was something about Jack Kirby that, you know, college students in the 60s were looking at him, but he was the Marvel style. And even to this day, looking at those old Fantastic Fours, even
they jump out at you.
They grab you. And when I was getting the Masterworks, it was, I think it was the Masterworks 6, when it was the Galactus trilogy and the Black Panther and Inhumans. I got in the mail. Like I said, I just have 20 minutes between work and going to the class at night. And I was out in the backyard with my dog, and I just opened, so let me thumb through it. Next thing you know, I'm late, and I'm running, trying to get to class. I'm like, I forgot where I was at. There's a magic to those that are second to none. And when they put the world's greatest comic book, you know, on it, usually that's hyperbole, but that one, it's absolutely. And I have to admit, even some of the later issues, like when Rick Buckler was drawing them, as a kid, 12 years old, I pick it up, and I said, world's greatest comic magazine. I says, that's kind of... And then I take it home and read it, and I thought, yeah, that was the world's greatest. It was just, there was a magic to it.
It was for a while there, yeah.
You know? And there was times where it came, I always liked the characters. You know, sometimes the art would catch me, and I'd pick one up and look at it. You know, I'm kind of neat. It's kind of strong. But the first 102 issues that Jack Kirby drew... second to none. I mean, as far as pure, unbridled imagination, and they were just going from one place to another and doing one thing to another, you didn't know what was going to happen next. Really, really strong work.
The best thing that Stan Lee did was let Jack Kirby do whatever the hell he wanted to.
He knew how to channel Jack Kirby.
Yeah.
You know, he let him do it, and then he just made it better.
Like,
you know.
Kirby, do these covers. Okay, good. Let's just knock them out. You know, no. And Kirby was free to do whatever he wanted. And he felt within the restraints of Marvel Comics, he worked way better than he did by the 70s when he went to DC, which he did some great work too.
Yeah.
But the Marvel, like, he created, it's almost like the DC universe was like, should have been part of Marvel Comics, you know. It never worked. It never worked as good over there. You know, it was great, but it would have been better within the Marvel Comics universe.
Yeah, you know,
within the Fantastic Four parameters.
How many times you see an athlete playing for one team? I in soccer, it's this way. Like, my favorite player was
charisma. You know, yeah. What I mean, chemistry. The chemistry in Marvel was better than it was in D.C.
You know, my favorite player is from France, is Thierry Henry, and he went to Arsenal in England. And the manager basically built the team around Thierry Henry. He was second to none. People were always shocked at him. Well, at one point he left Arsenal, and he went to Spain, to Barcelona. And I'm thinking, okay, well, Barcelona had a lot of other players. And, you know, Ronaldinho was there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Thierry Henry, he was good, but he wasn't the same as he was at Arsenal. You come to find out, he was told, you're not the first man. He wasn't even the fourth man. Well, the thing was, Arsenal, you're thinking, he was one of the greatest players in the world. But when he switched teams, different climate, different culture, I always thought that was what Jack... I loved a lot of the work. I loved Jack Kirby at DC.
It is second to Marvel's work. You know, I mean, is you can see right there it wasn't up, but I mean, some of it was just Big Barda, Olmec, you know, Commandy.
DC didn't package it right.
Yeah, they didn't know what they had. You know, but like I said, Jack Kirby went in and did it, and there were still, you know, fantastic things, but I don't know. Yeah, they got something that they didn't understand and didn't know what to do with.
They didn't understand it. If they should have, somebody, one of these guys that do brand new, they do comic book mashup covers, they should try to get an old New World book and try to Marvelize it, and you'll see how much it jumps out at you if you got the Stan, you know, stuff on it, and, you know, Marvel blockbuster classic or whatever, you know, the hype behind it was better for the Marvel books, I think, than the DC. DC was like, yeah, we got Kirby because he doesn't want to work with Marvel. Sure, come on over.
That's what I always thought was strange. They wanted him. Carmen Infantino brought him over and then didn't like him.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, but I was reading that they brought Jack Kirby over because DC was really trying to increase their sales, and it didn't happen. And I was also reading that Carmen Infantino was hired with the deal to bring up the, you know, numbers, and he never did. And then when they brought in Jeanette Kahn, you know, she was the editor for that Dynamite magazine, which it was sold in schools. I went to middle school. I never saw it, but I guess other younger kids had it. I finally started selling it in the supermarket. But they had a Marvel section in the middle of it. It was a kids' magazine, really slick, really nice, but that was Jeanette Kahn's baby. And she was a Marvel kid. And then DC hired her as the publisher, and she came in and she saw the problem, and, you know, she basically turned around, but she was the one that fired Carmen Infantino.
What room did you figure out what year it was?
Yeah, I was looking it up when I put the show together. That Carmen Infantino Warren job was from 1979.
Was it that late? Okay.
Yeah, and the thing was, a lot of the covers at DC, Carmen Infantino would draw rough out and have everybody draw from it. And sometimes they said he would rough out a cover and pass it on and said, come up with a story for this, you know, and then they draw the cover and everything else. But I guess anything he was drawing was sketchy and shorthand, and that was a problem he had when he left D.C. or was fired from D.C. It was all of a sudden he had to start drawing again, and he'd been working as an editor for, what, 5-6 years?
Mm-hmm.
Or as a publisher, and he'd only done roughs. But I think he was doing work for Marvel. He was doing Spider-Woman.
He went back to DC and did Flash again.
But he was doing Spider-Woman in 78. And which, like I said, I bought those. I liked them. I don't know how long he was with Marvel. But yeah, he did go back to DC.
He did go back, yeah.
But I saw him. He did some work for Star Reach. I think I saw a story. Stories here
he
and there.
He did a lot of freelance work after he left DC, and then he went back again, and then he freelanced for the rest of his career.
Yeah. You know?
But he always had a sketchy style, even in the... when he inked his own work in the 60s, when it was at his peak, you could see it was a little sketchy, unless Murphy Anderson got a hold of him, and then it was tight as, you know, drum or whatever.
But he got... Everything looked slanted. White and slanted. That's what, and it got worse as he got older, like lazier.
You know? I know what you mean. Yeah. He was fun though. He was a fun artist.
Yeah, he was distinct. Anyway, we've talked ourselves out. I guess that's about it. Just remember, we're a part of the Comics Podcast Network, and I'm kind of amazed at the array of shows that they have. I've listened to a couple of them. Pretty diverse. If you do get a chance, please give us a rating on iTunes, or even better, give us a review. It really helps us out. And Dallas will come on and tell you everything else that's available here. And in the meantime, read more comics.
You can find Al's other podcast, Slow Robot A Go-Go, Dallas's webcomic, The Mighty Blue, and Al's blog, Destination Nightmare, on the sidebar of our blog at bunchofdorks.com.
And click on the Cyclops!